after a successful raid on a Hydra base, Tony Stark and Bruce Banner create an artificial intelligence called Ultron, a peacekeeping protocol designed to help the Avengers protect the world from their enemies. But things go wrong when Ultron sees the human race as a threat and sets out to destroy it. Now, the Avengers, Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, the Hulk, Black Widow, and Hawkeye must reassemble to stop Ultron from causing mass destruction. Aside from this, the Avengers also must take on the powerful twins Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, as well as the new entity called Vision. Also, the Avengers find that things may never be the same again after discovering a power beyond their comprehension. Ciao, my people, and welcome to our 30th episode of Happiness and Darkness, the superhero movie podcast, where we cover superhero movies from Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, Image, and more. If it came from a comic and had a theatrical release, you know we'll discuss it. Naturally, there will be spoilers, folks, so you have been warned. I'm one of your co-hosts, DJ Nick, and as today is our 30th episode special, we will be discussing the second Avengers movie, Age of Ultron. And with me to discuss this sophomore outing of Earth's mightiest heroes is a perfect get of hosts, so let's count them down. First off, we have one of the co-hosts of Next Stop Everywhere, Titan Talk, Ghostwood, The Fandom Zone, and the blogger behind Damn Good Coffee and Hot, Charles Skaggs, who on the day this episode will be out, dear listeners, together with his lovely wife Laurie, is celebrating their 23rd wedding anniversary. Hey Charles, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Nick. How are you? How's things in Italy?
Well, you know, definitely cannot complain today because, you know, we have, I'm joined by four wonderful people, so I definitely cannot complain. Charles, I'm very, very happy to have you with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm definitely very glad to be here, as always. I can never say no to you, Nick.
You are way too kind. And secondly, we have the man behind the group, the Ohio Type 40 and Type 2 Doctor Who, John Takas. Hey, John, how are you doing?
Doing good, Nick. How are you?
And then great, you know, and super happy to have you with us today, John.
Thirdly, glad to be back.
Oh, of course, you know, always happy to have you back anytime. Thirdly, we have the man behind the Veterans Forum and the voice for the band Something Like Yesterday, Kelly Pippin. How are you doing, Kelly?
I'm doing good. Glad to be here today.
Wonderful, wonderful to have you with us. And last but certainly not least, the female presence, which will certainly classen up the joint for sure. Music and adult contemporary artist, Leslie Cause Mather. Hey, Leslie, how are you?
Hey, Nick. Hey, guys. Good to see you all.
Oh, well, we're very, very happy to have all four of you with us, guys. And so today we are reviewing Avengers Age of Ultron from 2015, directed and written by Joss Whedon, whom we had met in the first Avengers movie and, of course, Justice League. So as to keep it as brief as possible when it comes to the cast, what I will say, folks, it stars our main Avengers, of course, so Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, Iron Man, Chris Evans as Steve Rogers, Captain America, Chris Hemsworth as Thor, Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner, the Hulk, Scarlett Johansson as Natasha Romanoff, Black Widow, Jeremy Renner as Clint Barton, Hawkeye. This time, though, we have the additions of Aaron Taylor-Johnson as Pietro Maximoff, Quicksilver, Elizabeth Olsen as Wanda Maximoff, Scarlet Witch, Paul Bettany as Jarvis Vision, Andy Serkis as Ulysses Klaue, and James Spader as Ultron. So an estimate, guys, this film cost around $365 million to make, and it made over $1.403 billion at the box office. So another huge success. Did we enjoy it? We shall see. So, guys, as we did flesh out the characters in our previous Avengers podcast, I figured this time around we could touch upon specific topics and characters which pretty much highlight the film. So I would start with our first topic, which is new Avengers. In this case, of course, Quicksilver, Scarlet Witch, and Vision. So let's start with He's Fast, a.k.a. Aaron Taylor-Johnson as Pietro Maximoff, Quicksilver, who our listeners will might know from the Kick-Ass movies, Savages, Godzilla, and Nocturnal Animals. This was actually the second time we got the character of Quicksilver on the big screen, as a year prior he'd been played by Evan Peters in X-Men Days of Future Past. So let's start with you, Charles. What did you think of this Quicksilver?
I thought it was very interesting. I actually like this version of Quicksilver. I actually prefer this one compared to Evan Peters' version of Quicksilver for the X-Men movies. It depressed me that he ends up dying in this movie. because I just, you know, thought he was, you need to have the Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver together, their brother and sister. And you know, it was very frustrating to lose that character, especially knowing that, because apparently Marvel could only use Quicksilver in this movie before the Quicksilver rights had to go back over to Fox Studios for the X-Men. So but now that the rights are coming back, I'm hoping that maybe we could see the return of Aaron Taylor Johnson, because, you know, hey, superheroes have this tendency not to stay dead. And I think it would be great if they maybe brought him back in the WandaVision TV series that's going to be on Disney Plus.
Oh, I'm definitely hoping so, for sure. And what about you, John? What were your thoughts on Aaron Taylor Johnson as Quicksilver?
I have to agree with Charles on this one. I wasn't a really big fan of the version we got in the Fox X-Men movies. He just seemed a little bit more realistic, especially with his relationship with his sister. I know originally we were supposed to have this whole, that they were teasing somebody was going to die and everyone was picking Hawkeye. And when they killed Quicksilver instead, I was just like, okay, I can see that. I mean, I didn't want to see Hawkeye die, but also I started to really like the character of Quicksilver towards the end of the movie.
Well, you and me both. I mean, he's definitely a great character, for sure. And what about you, Kelly? Were you a fan of this Quicksilver?
Yeah, I was. I kind of agree, you know, with everybody else at this point. I think this was the best interpretation we've seen so far. Marvel has a way of, you know, Marvel and Disney have a way of putting the Marvel characters on the screen and making them relatable to their comic counterpart. I guess the only thing we couldn't call them mutants, because, you know, the whole Marvel Sony thing and Fox and all that stuff. You know, I'm glad they made it the way that they made it in this movie, and it worked out really well. And again, I'm sad he died, because you get attached to him as the movie progresses, because he does become an integral part of that situation. And then just, you know, I hope now they'll bring him back and things will, since, you know, Disney's buying up everybody, I figure at some point they're going to get the rights to everything. So we should be okay here in another couple movies or so.
Yeah, yes, indeed. It sounds like Disney is buying everything up. Apparently, in fact, yesterday, though, of course, it wasn't April Fool's, but I found it was rather funny. Disney apparently had announced that they had just bought the Formula One, you know, which was an interesting one. And they had like Goofy driving a Formula One car, which I thought it'll be kind of cool. And what about you, Leslie? Were you a fan of this Quicksilver?
Oh, yeah, I was. In fact, I feel the same way, except that I just learned now why they killed him off. I had no idea it had to do with rights. Makes sense. And I had the same feelings. Why don't they just find a way to bring him back to life? It's easy. It's a movie. I loved his comedic banter with Hawkeye. It was fun. It was lighthearted in the midst of all of it. And so, yeah, I agree. I hope they do bring him back. I also think that the brother-sister thing, you know, they could have done a lot with that. It could have gone a lot farther. So hopefully they do something with it. I agree. Yeah, mm-hmm. He was great.
In fact, that was something that I noticed a lot as well, because my opinion of this Quicksilver may somewhat be influenced by my appreciation for Aaron Taylor Johnson. Though I very much enjoy this version of Quicksilver, who I think is played, like others of you were saying, in a lot more of a serious fashion than what we got with Evan Peters' version. But both work, I think, for the way they're used. And being an older brother myself, I very much appreciated his endearing, overprotective nature when it came to his sister Wanda. And like the trait that we see in a lot of speedsters, at least in comics, is that he has a very short attention span. As you know, he's being used to moving constantly and fast forward. And maybe it's just the fact that he perceives everybody else as being slow. And I too was among those that were very upset that he was killed off, as it would have been nice to see more of him, especially, like you were saying, Leslie, the friendship he was starting to establish with Hawkeye. And it would have given the two, I think, a nice dynamic moving forward with the whole "you didn't see that coming" joke. And it was a shame. But apparently also the other problem was that Aaron Taylor-Johnson only signed up for the one movie. And hopefully they might convince him to come back because he plays superheroes so well. And also, I'm glad that they laid off what had been a cause of controversy among some comic book readers, that Pietro and Wanda had a weird incestuous relationship going on. At least that's what some people got from the comics, and I'm glad they steered away from that. But so all in all, it seems like we enjoyed Quicksilver. So speaking of Pietro's sister, let's move on to She's Weird, or Elizabeth Olsen as Wanda Maximoff, the Scarlet Witch, whom our listeners might know from Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, also Godzilla, Silent House, I Saw the Light, and Wind River. So let's start with you, John. What did you think of this very first, you know, big screen version of the Scarlet Witch?
I know she was like way different than her comic counterpart, but for this movie, I think she did a great job. And it was funny to see like the progression of her character through the, like, between the very beginning where they're basically Hydra's secret weapons, and they think they're complete badasses themselves. But then as they see the world's getting larger and all these other, like the Avengers are coming and they're not having that much luck with them. And obviously she does that great thing with the, like getting into their heads. But towards the end of the movie, you see her as more or less like a scared kid. And I like the fact that they put that human edge into it. I mean, even though she's got, I mean, she possibly could be one of the most powerful characters in the Marvel Universe, and she's still frightened when she needs to be. And so I really enjoyed that.
Definitely a very, very human, we get a lot of the human side of the character indeed. And what about you, Kelly? You know, you, of course, being a big fan of of the comics as well, did you like what we got from the page to the screen when it came to Scarlet Witch?
I did. I think Marvel did a really good job of her and her infancy of her power. That's what I feel like we're at right now. Mm-hmm. And I feel like she's progressing through the movies as we go, because the Scarlet Witch is one of the most powerful beings in the Marvel Universe, period. And she always has been. I mean, she's equal or surpassing Doctor Strange in most comics and things like that. There's a lot of things that she can do that we still haven't seen yet. And I feel like they're leading us, you know, into her growing up. And we get to see that starting here. And as we progress through the movies, I think we get to see more and more of it. And I was happy with the way that they handled that, and just the way that they're bringing this in. Obviously, in the comics, Scarlet Witch was long into her power before this particular situation came up. But the way that they drug her into this one, along with Quicksilver, just worked. I mean, the dynamic worked. We get to see, we get to see the human side, he said before, and it's just part of, I think they're just pushing us into this particular situation. And I think she's going to discover just exactly how powerful she is in the future. So
we can definitely hope so indeed with WandaVision coming out. And what about you, Leslie? You know, because of course we'd had a really strong female character in Black Widow prior to this, because of course Captain Marvel was a while away. What did you think of this, shall we say, second big female character introduced here in the MCU?
Yeah, you know, I come to your panel not as a as a comic book expert, and obviously the one woman on the panel, and that is exactly my take was, well, first of all, what I love about her is in an ensemble movie like this, you do see a full character arc for this one character. You know, you see her going from an antagonist, you think you're supposed to hate her, and by the end of the movie, you love her, and she's endearing, and she learns a lesson, and you get to see her background and why she's made the choices she's made, and you know, all of that takes you all the way through the movie, which is really impressive to me, considering how many characters were in this movie, and she was considered basically a secondary character in some ways. And so I loved that about her. I loved, just kind of, there was never a time when I didn't want to know more about her, and there were a lot of answers that they did give us, and now I do want to see more of her, and I don't know much about her powers, but I found them really interesting and hard to figure out. And to be honest with you, I felt like it's going to be interesting for me, as someone who's not aware of her powers, to get more of her in the future and see what she's capable of. Obviously a lot and varied things. So I don't know if it was that they didn't necessarily paint a clear picture or just my ignorance in it, all of it, but I know that in the future I'll be able to get some more answers, and that's a good thing for a, you know, movie watcher to look forward to.
Oh, yes. And I mean, and I think, you know, they definitely did the good thing with, you know, the scope of the powers at this point. What about you, Charles? Were you a fan of Scarlet Witch?
Yeah. I mean, I've been a long time Avengers fan. And so I was really looking forward to finally seeing Wanda in live action. And Elizabeth Olsen definitely doesn't disappoint. I think she's, you know, it's I really like her character arc along with Pietro's. Throughout this movie, that they start off, they have this, you know, this animosity, this hatred toward Tony Stark because of his weapons essentially being used to level their country and turn them into refugees and orphans. And of course, you know, Ultron kind of uses that to his advantage. And then through the course of the movie, like John was talking about, that, you know, that it, we get to see her progress, and that she kind of, along with Pietro, learns how to, you know, what's most important, and redeems herself as a character, as the Scarlet Witch we wanted to see. And so I thought, I really enjoyed that arc, and I thought it was a very natural progression toward her becoming an Avenger by the end of the film.
Well, and, you know, and of course, I suppose being the youngest of the Olsen girls, you know, as, yes, listeners, she is sister to the Olsen twins, Mary, Kate, and Ashley, who have both apparently abandoned show business, at least as actresses, while her baby sister is now starring in these multi-million dollar blockbusters. I thought that was rather interesting, you know, outside of the film, and may have also, I think, helped Elizabeth understand the twin dynamic, you know, being raised in the same household as her twin sisters. Potentially, you know, in the comics, the Scarlet Witch, like we've been saying, is one of the most powerful characters in the Marvel Universe, and I very much enjoyed this Scarlet Witch and seeing powers in action. It was amazing, and you can tell she's a very good natured woman with a desire to do good. And as soon as she realizes what Ultron's ultimate plans are, she and her brother quickly switch their alliance. And I suppose you cannot maybe blame her or Pietro for harboring major resentment, borderline hatred for Stark. And it does make you wonder if down the line they will continue to not trust him 100%, because I think there is still that underlying trust issue. There is, however, something I'm wondering. She seems all gung-ho when it comes to destroying Stark and the Avengers. But, you know, like John was saying, in the midst of battle, she has a meltdown, as it were, and then goes back into action after her pep talk with Hawkeye. So I was a little bit curious about that, but I guess, you know, maybe she hadn't seen, obviously, violence on that scope, as it were, or being thrown into action, that scope. But other than that, I thought it was great. And also, apparently, Elizabeth Olsen revealed that Joss Whedon was inspired by dancers as a way to visually represent how the character moves. And I suppose you can kind of see that a little bit. It reminded me of the Madonna video of Frozen, the way she was moving her hands about. I don't know, maybe that's me. That's just me. I just had Madonna's Frozen playing in the background when she was doing.
Oh my God.
I was like, okay, but yeah, that's just me. That's just me. It's me and my troubled mind. But as such, you know, and of course, you know, Olsen actually did train with a dancer to do all her, you know, little hand gestures. So that's I thought that was interesting. So as we talked about the Scarlet Witch, I think this is a great segue into another macro topic, which I like to call a million dreams or not so sweet dreams are made of this. So what did you guys think of the dream sequences, mind trips we got for the various characters and what it told us about their fears and backstories? Let's start with you, Kelly. Did you enjoy the mind trip scenes?
Yeah, they were fun. I mean, it gives you a little bit more insight. And it's, you know, I enjoyed it. It was part of the movie. I mean, I've been invested in these people for decades. So, you know, I like the backstory. I like the building of it. I like all that stuff that fell into it. I mean, they didn't make it an integral part of the film, but it was at least let us see where they came from and, you know, filled in a lot of the blanks that you didn't get because these are new people coming in. So, you know, it was kind of good. It was nice to see that. You kind of had an idea of where they came from in the first place and all this other stuff, but it just kind of filled in the gaps for all the new people that aren't comic book fans, and that's kind of what Marvel has to do at some points. So,
and I think that they've done a good job of that. What about you, Leslie? What did you think of the mind trips that Wanda sends our heroes on?
Well, again, it gives me more understanding of her and what she's capable of and why. And you know, one of the things that Marvel does so well is it presents the three-dimensional character. And it's why I think we're all so invested. I mean, I've been invested since the beginning and, you know, cried after the last movie. I mean, there's a familiarity to these characters that they build on with each movie and just get this depth of who they are. And so, you know, I agree. I think that it did give a little more insight. It did give more motivation to the characters and to the movie. And I thought it was well done and not overdone, which I think was also important.
Oh, yes. And Charles, you know, coming to you, you have seen mind trips in many situations, be it Doctor Who or the Titans and stuff. What did you think of these particular mind trips? Did you find them interesting?
One or two. I did find them interesting because essentially what it's done is to take the heroes off the board in the second act of the movie. And and cause them to doubt themselves. So it's kind of interesting, especially in Tony's vision, that it's almost kind of almost like a precognitive vision of what happens to him in Avengers Endgame a little bit. You know, where you see a lot of heroes have been taken out, and it's left up to him, and. So I kind of saw that as almost a little bit of foreshadowing. Obviously, probably not planned, but it kind of gives off that little vibe, I think. And so that my only problem with what Wanda did to all of the Avengers is that, like I said, it essentially takes the Avengers off the board in that second act. And so I wasn't a big fan of that. I thought it kind of slowed the movie way down. The pacing abruptly stopped for some character moments, which, okay, you know, you don't want to overload the budget. I get that. But, you know, just that's the only part. Otherwise, yeah, I thought they were very interesting. Thor's was interesting. And Cap's, obviously, it was great to see Peggy Carter again. You know, I love seeing Haley with Chris Evans. I think they have such great chemistry. I love their Steve and Peggy's romance. I think it's probably the best romance in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and especially since it got such a great happy ending. And I was very happy to see that. So the mind trips were great. What it leads into. Less so for me.
Hmm. And you, John, I mean, do you feel the same way Charles does? Do you feel that it slowed the movie down, or did you enjoy this sequence that we got?
Well, the only gripe I've ever had with this movie is that they give you so much in such a small span of time. And I think if they would have left out some of these, we could have kept on with the movie, like to just keep the flow going. I do have to agree with Charles with Tony's. And that's almost like a prediction. I mean, it's he saw what was to come. But the other ones, I mean, the one that I really would have loved to have seen would have been what she put into Banner's mind, just to make him just go completely nuts in that town. But for the most part, I liked what we got, but it did affect the pace of the film.
Mm. Well, I mean, so it seems like a lot of, you know, should we say 50% of the panel was not a big fan of this sequence. I thought it very interesting that in this case, you know, being, I guess, very sort of aware of music and stuff, that the music completely stops. which I think very much gives that air of eeriness and profundity. And in hindsight, like you, John, I would have loved to have seen what the Hulk actually sees, because you wonder whether he's seeing Thunderbolt Ross or even the Abomination. And it would have been cool to at least get a glimpse of that. But I think the most interesting and rather disturbing trip is actually Natasha's, as we get to see a little bit more of her past and the brutal training she had to go through, not to mention the fact that she was sterilized. And also, when you see these the two little girls with no mouths, I kind of got like almost a Shining vibe from that, which was interesting. And also, that, like you were saying, the first mind trip we get with Tony early on, in hindsight, is very much a prelude of things to come. And hey, it may have continued to then haunt him throughout, and which they may have then impacted the decisions he ultimately makes in future movies. So definitely an interesting rewatching it, in knowing what we know now. And finally, guys, we get to the third new character introduced in this film, and who will get very cozy with Wanda down the line. Paul Bettany as Jarvis Vision. Our listeners will probably know him from Gangster Number One, A Knight's Tale, Master and Commander, The Da Vinci Code, and recently also Solo. So when it comes to you, Leslie, what did you think of Paul Bettany now that they've given him a body and he's not just the voice of Jarvis?
Yeah, exactly. Everyone loves Jarvis. Everyone's always loved Jarvis. And I think it was brilliant to, you know, to segue into Vision the way they did. Love the actor. And he's so likable in this character. I mean, he's got such a vulnerability about him. And yet, you know, now, especially as Vision, what he's capable of, if you bring all of that with him, it's really a brilliant, I personally think it's brilliant casting. I loved the costuming. I thought there's just, you know, even the lines that he gave, you know, he's not sure he's on anyone's side, but he's on the side of life, and Ultron's on the side of death and destruction. And you know, and I was born yesterday, and those little, quippy, but I don't know, just he's so empathetic, this you know, this non-human, and yet you just feel this sense of sensitivity from him. I love what they did, and I love how you know, when you think you see the whole thing happening with Ultron and Vision, you know, or Jarvis at the time, before everything really came, you know, into actually Ultron in that robotic form and later Vision. But I love even the dialogue there, you know, I can't access the mainframe, and Jarvis is, you know, goes into hiding. And I thought that they really, again, from the very beginning of like Iron Man 1, you know, with Tony and Jarvis and that whole thing, all the way through Vision, it's another way of investing in this character long-term, that even though the character segues, you still feel like you know him when he comes about as Vision.
And I suppose, you know, he could only be played by Paul Bettany, having been the voice of Jarvis. And what about you, Charles? You know, you being a fan of the Avengers comics, did you like the Vision that we got on screen?
I love Paul Bettany as the Vision. I think he's great. And, you know, he was established, and he brings, you know, that the Vision is such a complex character. So, it's great to have somebody with the range of Paul Bettany bringing that to the role. You know, he's essentially like the, if you're a fan of Star Trek: The Next Generation, you know, he's essentially like Data. He's the android that longs to be human and have those human relationships. And so, you know, he's obviously going to be a fascinating character as we go through his journey. And, you know, I thought it was a great introduction, and to see him have that, you know, that connection with Ultron, I thought was great. And, you know, and I love the fact that we got to see the very early hints of the Vision Scarlet Witch romance. I thought that was great, because those two, you know, Paul Bettany and Elizabeth Olsen play very well off each other, as we've seen in later movies. And, you know, we get a little hint of that here. And I think another one of the great scenes, of course, is, you know, when you're Joss Whedon wanted everybody to kind of doubt the Vision at first, you know, when he's with the Avengers, like, especially, you know, like he'd just been created, like they're good. The Avengers are going, well, can we really trust this guy? And then we see him able to lift Thor's hammer after that whole sequence of everybody else not being able to lift it, apart from Captain America, who at this point can just budget a little bit, much to Thor's chagrin and surprise. And so, but the Vision just picks it right up and is ready to just toss it around like nothing. So it shows that, you know, you could this character could be trusted. And I thought that was important.
Very well said. And what about you, John? You know, you being the Iron Man fan and, you know, obviously, I'm sure, loving Jarvis in the Iron Man solo movies. What do you think of you know, this now appearance of the Vision?
I thought they pulled it off tremendously. I've been a huge fan of him playing Jarvis. And then just to bring that to life into an actual character. And one of the things that Charles just said with the when he lifted up the hammer, and you could go back with the screenplay on this, they had set it up at the party, and everyone's just like, no way can lift the hammer. And then all of a sudden here comes Jarvis, and they can't trust him. They don't know if he's good or bad, but here's the hammer. So okay, I guess you're worthy. And it just solidifies their trust in him for the rest of the movie. And I think Paul Bettany, I think he did a great job as, he's always done the voice, but I haven't seen him a whole lot in other features. So when I actually got a chance to see him as Vision, he was there. And I was just like, okay, here's Vision. I was afraid they were going to do like Charles said, like a Data from Star Trek. Or even like a Spock-like character who's very powerful, just like it's not logical. But the way that was between the writing and the acting, I think he did a great job.
Well, so it definitely seems like there's a lot of love for the Vision going on. Let's see what did you think about him, Kelly? Do you have love for the Vision in this film?
Well, I've always been a fan of Paul Bettany, and when he played the voice of Jarvis, that made my day every time Tony Stark says Jarvis, you know, whatever. I think, you know, because they're crunching so much into so much time and Ant-Man wasn't a factor yet, I think the fact that Hank Pym wasn't involved in some of this stuff kind of at first kind of threw me a little bit, because now we're dealing with Banner and Stark, and I'll get more into that when we get to Ultron. But, the whole thing with him becoming the Vision was just an amazing trip through the movie. I felt like when he first arrived, the reason they didn't trust him is because he was very calculating. He was very emotionless at, you know, kind of in the first part of his existence. And I think his conversation with Ultron at the end ultimately ties him to the Avengers and ties him to the good guys. And really, you know, he lifts the hammer. The Avengers are like, okay, cool. He's worthy. You know, the hammer responds to a pure heart. That's, you know, your intentions are what allows you to lift the hammer. And that's why Cap was able to budget. And at that time, the Vision had no ill intentions towards anyone. I mean, that was the whole point. And so, you know, when you go back and you think about the lore of the hammer and you talk about the conversation he has with Ultron towards the end of the movie, when they're standing in the woods and, you know, it's kind of like, okay, now you're starting to understand where he's coming from and why he actually cares so much about what's happening and what's going on and why Ultron is ultimately the villain here. And, you know, it's kind of complex all in and of itself, but it flows through the movie so well. And, you know, like John said earlier, the writing on it was just so quick and so neat and so put together that it made it work. So,
well, it definitely some great writing indeed. And what I actually love most about the film version is they retain the good and naive nature of the character. I mean, it kind of reminded me of, you know, you guys talked about, you know, the possibility of maybe him being Data or Spock. I actually got very much a Jack Haley's portrayal of the Tin Man in the 1939 Wizard of Oz movie. That's the impression that I got. It might be the fact that I absolutely love the Wizard of Oz, but I think that's the impression I got. As like the Tin Man, we very much see that though he might be an android, Vision is one of the most sensitive and thoughtful members of the Avengers, and almost puts humans to shame about how much he values life. Right. And is, of course, you know, the direct opposite to Ultron. you could almost see a Christ versus Antichrist relationship. I mean, the Vision is one has always been one of my favorite characters in the comics, and I was so excited to see him get his big screen debut. And actually, you know, just throwing it out there, guys, were any of you fans of the comics, were you upset that they changed his origins and the fact that they gave him an Infinity Stone in his head rather than the solar jewel he has in the comics? Were any of you comic book fans upset about that?
I wasn't. Yeah, I mean, it made sense because leading up to Infinity War.
Yeah. And I think as, you know, in future movies, when we get to those, I think we'll see there's a reason behind that. So, you know, there's a plot that goes along the line here. So I think we'll still see the comic version, you know, of that. But right now, I think leading up to this, they did a really good job of using one of the Infinity Stones.
And the only thing I could say in regards to that is that you got to figure that when they're making these films, they're not just making them for comic book fans. They got to get a large amount of people in those seats. So they're going to put their own little spin on it. So you don't have to go back and say, okay, well, why wasn't this character here if he helped create him, and where's Hank Pym and all this? And I think they did a nice job with solidifying that, though.
Well, then it seems like the comic book fans are appeased, which is definitely always a good thing. Okay, so Kelly, you actually touched up on this earlier. Let's get to our next topic here, Peace in Our Time, where we have this, shall we say, dichotomy between Tony Stark and Bruce Banner. The relationship that is established between these two when it comes, you know, to their views on using an AI to protect the world, and ultimately the great fight we get between these two in Africa, obviously Bruce is the Hulk. But what do you guys think of the budding relationship between Tony and Bruce that started in the first Avengers movie? Let's start with you, Charles. What were your thoughts on this Stark-Banner relationship?
Yeah, I love the Science Bros. I think they're just a lot of fun together. The only problem is that this is with the dark side of the Science Bros, where they kind of go off and they do their own thing and they end up creating like this evil AI as a result, you know, with Ultron. And obviously it's Tony once again going through things with good intentions, and it all goes horribly, horribly wrong. And then he has to spend the rest of the movie having to kind of fix his mistake, his and Banner's mistake. So, you know, it's obviously a little bit different. Obviously coming from the comics, I was used to like Hank Pym being the creation for Ultron. And so I was a little confused, you know, like not really confused, but it just a little disappointed that wasn't the case here. But, you know, obviously it gave Robert Downey Jr. more screen time. So I kind of see why they did it and went this way.
Oh, well, definitely. And what about you, John? What did you think of the Tony Stark and Bruce Banner relationship?
I really enjoyed it. It was like two geeks at a convention together, having a great time working on different things. But then when you start to see that Tony's main vision is, Tony wants to retire. He doesn't want to do this the rest of his life. That's why he wants to create like that, a suit of armor around the world. And by just like coming up with different little quips of, it's like, well, maybe if I do this and this and this, but then Bruce is over here like, no, you can't do that. And it almost seems like Tony becomes like the bully of the relationship for a while, even though, I mean, Banner could just switch it on and take him out. But he starts to go with it after a while, and it just the whole thing with by the time Thor comes in and says, okay, well, Banner or Stark was right, the look on Bruce's face is just like, wait a second, what? And I really like the fact that it's just like I said, like two geeks let loose in a convention and they're having a good time, they're doing what they got to do, and they just one just kind of steers towards that wrong path, but in his eyes, he's right.
I definitely love the two geeks at a convention comparison for sure. What about you, Kelly? What did you think of our two, should we say, geeks at play?
Well, I mean, I love the dynamic. I mean, obviously, you've got two brains the size of, you know, whatever. you know, it's one of those things that I feel like is, you know, it's just, it's the, I don't know, it's kind of like the end of the world gathering, you know? These guys are trying to create something to stop something and wind up doing exactly the opposite of it. I also feel like that this was the wedge that started between Captain America and Iron Man. And I feel like leading into Civil War, you know, as we get further into the movies, but I think these little things that Tony does with good intentions still drives that wedge between him and some of the other Avengers. And I think it's part of this is why the Hulk leaves. And I think part of this is why everybody else, I'm trying to get my camera here, guys, but I think that's why everybody else kind of goes the way they go later in the movies. But the dynamic between the two was amazing. It was thoughtful. It was well put forth. Again, I agree with Charles that, you know, the Hank Pym aspect of that is not there. And I mentioned that earlier, a little bit of a disappointment, but he wasn't actually, you know, he wasn't actually a part of this yet. So, you know, we do have that, and we do have to make a movie for everybody, and it has to relate. And obviously Tony Stark, Robert Downey Jr. has created that entire, I mean, this whole Marvel universe started on his back. So giving him that time was important, I think.
Yes, yes, indeed. And, you know, speaking of making a movie for the non-comic book fans, Leslie, what did, you know, you having followed the movies and getting to the point of Age of Ultron, what did you think of this, the relationship between Tony and Bruce and, you know, and what we got in this movie between the two?
Yeah, I found that interesting news about Hank Pym. I that would have been really cool. I agree with you on that. I didn't know. I have felt like I don't dislike Mark Ruffalo's version of Hulk at all, but I do feel like he's always been such a bit of a pushover. There was no doubt in my mind that Tony was going to get his way. You know, Tony was going to bully him into what Tony wanted. And I did like that, you know, that Banner pushed back both times, but it was going to happen. I mean, he was going to do what Tony wanted. I did think it was important that, we had to see Tony's questionable motivations, obviously foretelling what was coming later on. There needed to be sort of a breach in trust, or at least a questionable trust of his intentions so that later, you know, in Civil War, there was even more to grow with, you know, to grow on. It definitely moved the movie along really well. And second time around, it added to the motivation of them not wanting him to try again. Thankfully he did, and we have Vision, but it certainly was a good way to move it to that point where, other than Thor coming in and intervening, it might not have happened. So I thought it was well done. Yeah.
Yeah, it might not have happened for sure. And you know, we had seen, obviously, in the first Avengers movie that Tony was a huge fan of Bruce's and saw him as one of his equals, you know, it came to intellect and the understanding of science and technology. And I definitely agree with John Newman when he says that Tony is very much the adventurous type, more of a daredevil in all aspects of life. While, as Leslie was saying, Bruce is very much the more cautious and pondering man. And it makes for an interesting debate when it comes to two, for sure. And then, of course, this then we burst in the Hulkbuster versus Hulk fight, which is very much one of the big action moments in the film. And you have to love Tony's ad-libs during the fight, which I think would definitely make Spider-Man proud. And from Green War... And from Green War to Green Love. And one of the reasons a lot of folks were upset with this film, the budding love between the Hulk and Black Widow. Let's start with you, what did you think of what they gave us with this Green Love, let's say?
I'm sorry, who are you starting with?
John.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Okay.
I didn't hear my name there. I wasn't a big fan of it. It really seemed like, okay, I mentioned before, you got Banner's geekiness, and here comes Natasha, who's laying it on really thick, but it almost sounds like she's working when she's talking to him. And I didn't really believe it. I mean, that was some of the, I love the dialogue in this movie, except for the two of them. And there's some great dialogue scenes, especially when you've got the, when they're on board that freighter, Ultron says, Thor says, nothing's going to be broken today. And Ultron says, well, if you're going to make an omelet, and Tony comes right back. He said, he beat me by 1 second. And it's just that kind of dialogue that I was loving in this film. But then when you get the two of these, together, it didn't work for me. I mean, I liked when Tony came in later on and said, you and Banner better not be playing hide the zucchini. But I didn't believe the relationship.
Oh, okay. So you weren't a fan of this. What about you, Kelly? One of your key phrases has always been, don't mess with my universe. What did you think of the fact that they made this potential relationship between the Hulk and Black Widow?
I'm with John. I'm with a fan. I get they needed something to calm down the Hulk, and they've used that relationship as such. Betty Ross was that in the comics. And I feel like they're using the Widow for that. There's a lot of things as to why Betty Ross hasn't been a character yet and other things, but that's a long story and you can dig in that hole forever. But the whole point is that they're using her as the catalyst for the Hulk. And I understand that. I get it. I kind of get why Natasha would find Banner, maybe attractive, because he's like the safe bet when he's not the Hulk, because he's a good guy. He has no ill will towards anyone, and he spends his entire life trying not to be the Hulk to make sure nobody gets hurt. And I get the admiration there. I just don't get the relationship. It comes with the territory. But again, it's a little of a rough spot for me, and it's still, and like I said, I'm famous for saying don't mess with my universe. I'd rather kind of see Betty Ross in there somewhere, but hey, it is what it is. We move on and keep going. And it's a little bit of a stumbling block, but I think after everything that's happened in the future movies, I think some things are going to change now. So we'll see how Marvel handles this in the future. But as of this movie, no, I'm not a huge fan of the relationship. So.
And from that very strong stand on Kelly's part, what about you, Leslie? Did you ship these two together, or weren't you a fan?
I was not. There were some things about it that I think, well, okay. First of all, I do think that it worked for me that she was the one to calm him down. That worked for me, and I think it was because women are very different than men. We want to be badasses too. And when there's a badass woman on screen, if she's nothing but badass and you never see her weak points and you never see her vulnerability, then as another woman, you kind of don't like her. She's a threat. But if you find her relatable, then you can root for her. And they needed to do something with her to make her likable and relatable to other women. And I thought that was a failure in terms of Banner, because and then they never even followed up with it. So I think when they tracked the movie's responses, it ended up being, let's just ignore this for the next movie, because we go all the way through Endgame and you really don't even see the relationship ever again. It seemed so strange that they just kind of left it and forgot about it after this movie. But it actually, there was more chemistry between Hawkeye, who's married with kids, than there was, I thought, between Banner and Natasha. I think, like you said, somebody said, John, maybe it seemed scripted. It seemed like she was working him or something. I did like the insight into the fact that it's pretty clear, at least in this movie, that she's done. She wants to quit. She wants to run away. And again, I liked that vulnerability. And then the insight into the fact that that's why she likes him, because he knows he can win and he doesn't want to hurt anybody. And that I liked, but to me, that's more platonic. It's friendship. It's not this big, let's, run off together and be a whatever it is they're going to be thing. So, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And Charles, did you buy this relationship?
Yeah, absolutely not. I did not buy this relationship at all. I love the Black Widow. I thought I think she's a great character. I love her in the comics. And so what Joss Whedon does here in trying to give her vulnerability, it takes too much away from the character's essence, in my opinion. I love the fact that, you know, we got to see more of her Red Room background, at least little hints of that during, you know, the mind effing. But, when it comes around to the relationship, to see her suddenly, have this relationship with Bruce Banner and, in this kind of almost Beauty and the Beast type relationship, mm-hmm. It didn't really, it seemed very contrived, very forced. Banner is someone that generally Natasha wouldn't be interested in. And I get the fact that they kind of hinted at that. Well, that's kind of why she liked him, was that he was a little bit different and it was more of an unexpected relationship for her. But to kind of see her being, typically such a strong, confident woman, suddenly, feeling regretful about not having kids and not having this other life, it seemed very uncharacteristic to me. To Leslie's point, I get that they were trying to make the Black Widow more relatable, but I don't think this was the way to do it. And I think Whedon kind of dropped the ball here in a big way.
Well, I suppose I might be the more optimist of the group here, because I was in two minds about this relationship. When I first saw this movie, it was very much the part, like you guys, that upset me the most. But on the rewatch, I actually did not mind it as much. I mean, you'd think that Nat would probably have her pick of men, and she goes with the dork who is all fluff, and I suppose that makes sense. Though at the same time, I suppose the relationship itself could make sense, as they both come from dramatic and traumatic pasts, and she feels she was made as much into a monster as Bruce was, her with her cold-blooded killer training, and he with his gamma ray accident. And you have to find the super nerdy doctor and this incredibly attractive, sexy woman who is throwing hints at him constantly kind of endearing. And at first, I wondered whether he was just playing dumb at Tony's party, or like a lot of guys, as Leslie can probably confirm, fail to read a woman's sign. So I enjoyed that. But yeah, I mean, I can see why it was dropped at the end of the day. But I wasn't so troubled about it on the rewatch, I suppose, because, thinking of, the nerdy guy and the beautiful woman and stuff. So I thought it was okay. It wasn't great, but it was okay. And so from a budding troubled romance to one which Leslie was touching up on has already bloomed and then some, let's talk about the Hawk's Nest and Hawkeye's family. And in particular, we meet his wife, Laura Barton, played by Linda Cardellini, which is in Italian actually means goldfinch. So no surprise, it's almost serendipitous. They found an actress who actually has the surname, which is that of a bird. thoughts on, so what did you guys think on this slice of an Avengers family life? Let's start with you, Kelly. What did you think about the Hawk's Nest and the fact that we get to see that Hawkeye is a married man?
Well, I think in this movie, it kind of humanizes Hawkeye a little more. In a lot of the former movies, Hawkeye's always been kind of a, and Jeremy Renner does a great job of playing him, I think he's always been pretty calculated. And I think getting to meet his family in this, granted, we're a little off kilter from the comics in this particular situation, but I think getting to meet them and getting the chance to, it brings you closer to the character. It gives you a little more, it gives you that, all that emotion. You're attached. You're like, okay, this guy's out here risking his life. He's one of the only people, other than Natasha, that isn't superpowered in the Avengers. And, here he is, holding his own, and he's got a family. And, it humanized Hawkeye and gave him a little bit more of a story to tell. And it really, I don't know how necessary it was, but it did help the story along in certain aspects. And it gave the Avengers some place to be when they needed to be somewhere other than, you know, in a city or, you know, destroying something or whatever the case may be. So I felt like, you know, yeah, it was a good thing. I enjoyed that particular part of it. And again, it just kind of humanizes your hero again, you know, brings you back to, okay, this is a real person kind of situation. So from that aspect, I enjoyed it. So.
And what about you, Leslie? What did you think about Hawkeye, what we saw about Hawkeye and you know, his family and such?
Yeah, I think, you know, you always have to think, what is the filmmaker going for, and what dynamic is he going for? And again, I think he was going for my demographic. I think he was going for women, and in addition to other things. But I think it was an important thing to, as Kelly said, to show the more human, more three-dimensional side of him. And because it was a very different side than we had seen before. And I liked the other Avengers' reaction. You know, they had no idea. And it was kind of fun to, because I think a lot of the audience was doing the same thing, and it was played out on screen that they had no idea these people even existed. I think it was also foreshadowing again to Hawkeye's motivation later on, you know, in movies to come, because there really isn't a greater motivation than if you have someone close that is being threatened. And, and I also thought that it increased the background friendship again between Nat and Cliff, and it just allowed you to see that there was a deep relationship between the two of them that again plays out later, you know, as the movies progress. So it worked for me, and I kind of liked the break in you know, superhero to human aspect of it as well.
It's definitely a nice little change. And what about you, Charles? Because I know that you were actually quite invested in the Hawkeye character in comics. What do you think of what we got here? And you know, more of Hawkeye as on screen and his family life.
Yeah, I was a little thrown by it because of being used to Hawkeye in the comics being this kind of cocky, a little bit of a goofball at times character, and, you know, who really isn't a family man. And then to see Jeremy Renner's portrayal here with Hawkeye having a wife and kids and this secret life away from the Avengers that he's keeping almost compartmentalized away from the Avengers, it took some getting used to, but I actually kind of enjoy it. You know, obviously, I think it was central to the plot because, like, I believe Kelly mentioned that, you know, it gave the Avengers somewhere to go after they're reeling from Wanda's mind tricks. And it was kind of nice. And, you know, to see and it obviously gave Hawkeye a lot of character development. You know, we got to see him outside of his superhero role and to see him as just a regular person, and, you know, who has, you know, normal concerns, relatable concerns, and which I'm like I said is probably the point of this. And I also found it interesting that, you know, that Black Widow Natasha was in on this. She knew about it, and she did, obviously Black Widow, you know, she's very good at keeping secrets, so it made perfect sense for her to keep that from the Avengers and respect Hawkeye's privacy. But I like the fact that, you know, she was kind of in on it. The kids already knew her as Auntie Nat. And then I thought that, and then some of those scenes there were very charming. And and I really enjoyed those.
They were very charming for sure. And what about you, John? Did you like what we saw at when it came to the Hawk's Nest and Hawkeye's family?
I really did. And I understand the fact that the comic character and the on-screen character are two different people. But what we got, and it's been said before, it really humanized that character. And I love the fact that he gets in and she says, okay, well, you just saved the world, but you're going to work in the dining room next or whatever. And it's just like, it just brought a whole different reality to it, to the point where it even later on in the movie, when he's gotten Nat in the car with him, he's like, okay, dining room. I'll just blow out that wall. And who eats in the dining room anyway? Everyone eats in the kitchen. I loved it because it made him more real to me. I mean, it was that handyman husband that, guess what? He's a superhero. And when the lights are out, this, that, and the other. But I really enjoyed it. And I liked the fact that when they went there, it humanized the rest of them. I mean, obviously Thor takes off right away, but here's Steve chopping wood. Here's Tony getting ready to fix their tractor that won't start. It gave a more human aspect to each of them. And the fact that Nat was just, she knew him to begin with. That just, I love the fact that, okay, here's this spy that this might be the biggest secret she's keeping from anybody, is that he's got a family on the side and he's protecting him by not saying anything about it. So yeah, I really liked it.
I mean, I think a big action movie or any good roller coaster needs moments of quiet, such as this, the one we get here, as those moments, I think, are quieter when you actually get to know your characters better and not have them be, you know, one-dimensional action heroes. And though we didn't get much of her, I actually thought the character of Laura Barton is very much key, as in, it's almost our point of view into this world of godlike people. Mm-hmm. And of course, then we find out how strong the bond of friendship, like you guys were saying, runs between Nat and Clint, as evidently she knows Laura and the family. And the fact that Clint's future son is then named Nathaniel and also Pietro as a second name, which I thought was a nice nod to the aforementioned friendship between Clint and Quicksilver, and of course his sacrifice. And also, when it comes to the wood chopping scene, which you touched on during the time of the event, if you look at Cap's file and Tony's, you can clearly see that Tony is spending more time chatting than actually chopping wood. So
hey, don't touch Tony's pile.
Yeah, don't take from his pile.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I thought that was kind of fun. And so from chopping woods to an entire jungle of trees, if you will, which takes us to our very first introduction of where vibranium comes from, and our next topic, which I like to call Welcome to Wakanda, where we get a brief yet, I feel, interesting and entertaining appearance by a villain that Marvel Comics fans will know, Andy Serkis as Ulysses Klaue, who our listeners will probably know as the voice of Gollum in The Lord of the Rings, as Caesar in the Planet of the Apes movies, and also he was in I believe it was the basis for King Kong, and who so far is confirmed to be directing the second Venom film, which I am very excited about. So, speaking actually of Andy Serkis and the character of Ulysses Klaue, what did you think of him, Leslie?
Well, I think you just love to hate him. I mean, he's so brilliant. And he, you know, as we know from the future movies, he somehow finds a joy for whatever his crazy life is right into the moment that he dies. He's laughing, you know. I think he's despicable, and he almost just doesn't care. I mean, I thought he was pretty, well, I don't even know, despicable yet likable, you know, at the same time. I thought it was great casting, and love his accent, love his voice. The man's just a brilliant actor, and so I think also, you know, we all love, if we didn't know about Vibranium and Wakanda and all of that before, you know, seeing the movie, and to go back and see it and knowing what you know, it's just like more information, more little details of what they're going to flesh out later. And the Vibranium thing is so fascinating, and the whole, the way they use it, you know, somebody said in the movie, I think it was Ultron who said, yeah, and they made a frisbee out of it, you know, and it's just this extremely valuable, you know, made up element that I just think he did a fantastic job with it.
So definitely a fan of Andy Serkis on one side. What about you, Charles? Did you like Andy Serkis and the Ulysses Klaue we got here?
Oh, yeah, I've been a fan of Andy Serkis ever since the Lord of the Rings movies. You know, he's an incredible performer, both physically and vocally. And he brings so much to Klaue, who in the comics is essentially a one-dimensional villain. Mm-hmm. And he gives a lot of personality. Claw, you know, he's here, you know, he's the kind of guy who really enjoys what he does. You know, what he does is pretty despicable times, but you have to respect someone who really enjoys their work, I think. And and I think that's Ulysses Claw. When the scene where Ultron just casually, without even thinking, rips off Ulysses Claw's arm, it was something that any comics fan probably saw coming, because it sets up the fact that, you know, he gets that the sonic device, the sonic replacement arm that we see later in Black Panther. And so it's obviously he's finally getting his his supervillain ability, and so you can just check off that box. But other than that, it was a great, it's a great way, I think, to start to tease the introduction of Wakanda and setting up the eventual Black Panther movie. I thought that was a great way to do it. And, I just really enjoyed the character, and I really enjoyed Andy Serkis.
And what about you, John? What did you think of Ulysses Claw?
I'm really glad that they went the way they did with the direction of the character, because, yeah, like Charles said, in the comics he is completely different. I mean, there's some storylines in the past where he's more just completely mentally unstable, to the point where it's like, okay, just defeat him and get rid of him, because I'm tired of watching this guy. But what Andy Serkis brought to the role, you could easily say he's one of the hardest working actors in Hollywood. He's always wearing a mocap suit, so he's always doing something. He's either crawling or jumping, to actually see the acting chops behind the voice that we normally just get. I mean, it was really nice to see him in action that way too. Because like you mentioned before, Gollum, Caesar. All you hear is his voice, but he is wearing those motion capture suits. So to actually see the full performance by him, I really enjoyed his performance.
And what about you, Kelly? What did you think of Ulysses Claw in this film?
Well, I mean, seeing Andy Serkis off of a green screen with his actual face and getting to see him act, it's a huge thing. He's a huge comedic actor, and he's a huge physical actor. And, you know, like everybody's been talking about, what made me enjoy this character was Andy Serkis. It wasn't necessarily, the way he handled it, the way, this guy is, as underhanded as they come. And it's just who he is. And he pulls this off in this movie so well that, you really want to hate this guy. And at some times you just want to laugh at him. And at other times you kind of get where he's coming from. So, I mean, you go through that whole gambit with this character, and it's really fun to watch how all that has progressed onto the screen. And then into later movies, we still get another good dose of him in the Black Panther, but it's just a fun character to put into this movie to give it a little more. And I'll say lightheartedness, because that's any Serkis, anytime he plays a physical role like that, it really brings down he's bad, but at the same time, it's just fun to watch. So,
well, I mean, like you guys, some of you mentioned before, I will point out that though Ulysses Claw is rather different from this, at least in the comics version, I really love this. Just to give our listeners some comics background, he is strongly tied to Wakanda and Vibranium, as he's actually the son of Nazi Colonel Fritz Claw, who had actually been sent to Wakanda by Hitler to discover Wakanda's secrets. And after the war, Ulysses' father had moved to Belgium and changed his name to K-L-A-W, as originally it was K-L-A-U-E. Ulysses himself is a physicist who is the one who kills Black Panther's father, T'Chaka, in the comics. And it's T'Challa, i.e. Black Panther, who is the cause for Claw losing his right hand. That said, being half South African, though he is a villain, I was very impressed by the very convincing South African accent. It was very well done. And I suppose that in this case, it was also a callback to Stark's bellicose past and arms dealing and Klaw is very much your typical arms dealer. He's all about profiting from shady and nefarious business activities. And he's definitely a villain I enjoy. He's, like you guys were saying, he's just so fun to watch. And he's just all about the Benjamins, as they say. Though I'm surprised that when Ultron slices his arm off, he barely acknowledges it, as you'd think he'd be rolling around in pain over that. But I guess he's using Ulysses Klaw, so he's a badass, so he can take it. But that, I absolutely loved it.
And I just want to know where the blood was.
Exactly. Where was
where was that Disney, blood?
Disney, give us the blood. But it's Disney, so I suppose the House of Mouse said no
it's
blood.
It's exactly.
It's the House of Mouse. Mickey Mouse said no.
It like was a clean Sonic break. Games, a clean pluck.
And so let's get to the man who slices off Klaw's arm and the big bad in this film, Mr. James Spader as Ultron. Our listeners will probably know him from Sex, Lies, and Videotape to Stargate, Crash, Secretary, and of course The Office and The Blacklist. So what did you think, Charles, about the Ultron we got in this film?
I was a little disappointed, to be frank. I think James Spader does a nice job, but I don't like this depiction of Ultron. I like my Ultron a lot more psychopathic, homicidal, and all around just plain evil. I thought the character design, I was not a fan of that because it tried to give him, you know, humanize him and give him a more humanoid face and facial expressions. But in the comics, Ultron has basically this, you know, just this soulless red triangle, angry triangle eyes and this nightmarish face, almost like a kind of a, you know, like a cybernetic jack-o'-lantern. And I think it kind of takes away from Ultron's being, you know, this really scary villain by humanizing him here. And, you know, I kind of get why they did it. But, you know, and maybe it's also because of James Spader's performance. I think James Spader is a great actor. He's phenomenal in the TV series Boston Legal, if you've ever watched that. And but here he, you know, he's far too calm and, you know, and monotone. And so it doesn't really scream Ultron to me.
So definitely not a fan of this on-screen version. What about you, John? You know, what did you think of Ultron?
I have to really echo a lot of what Charles just said. It's it wasn't the Ultron I was hoping for. I'm used to seeing just like he said, the homicidal. It's just really something you have to stop because it's he's just going to keep on going and going and going. And I would have loved to have seen a little bit of a different kind of take with the visuals we got with him, because anytime you see Ultron in the comics when he's screaming, especially like classic Ultron, you see that like kind of like a smoke or something kind of like coming out of his mouth. And the homicidal jack-o'-lantern, that's exactly what, that's the best description possible of him.
Thank you.
as an actor, James Spader, I have enjoyed a lot of the stuff I've seen with him, but I think they could have had, I really wanted somebody with more of like a higher pitched voice to show that like maniacal kind of personality that he has, but I really wasn't that much of a fan. I did like the fact that whenever, like in his earlier stages, when they would destroy him, he would jump into another body and keep it going like that. But I think that's the only part that I really enjoyed of him.
And what about you, Kelly? You know, you also being a fan of the comics, were you happy with this Ultron?
I'm going with Charles and John on this one. And I'm saying no. I was actually talking to somebody about this the other day. Ultron is a very menacing character in the comic books, and he's a very feared villain. And in the comics, he kind of brands himself. I don't know if you guys know this. I'm sure Charles and John, you know, that, you know, he came out with himself like versions of Apple has come out with phones. Right. Every time he would reanimate, he, you know, and he's always had that, you know, like Charles and John said, he's always had that gaping maw in the comics with that energy bouncing around in it, smoke coming off of it. You know, I just didn't feel that in this movie. And a friend of mine and I were talking about this. you know, like the Joker in the Batman movie, that's a menacing character, and that's what I wanted out of Ultron, because that's what he is in the comics. He's been compared kind of to the Joker in different places sometimes, but this Ultron, again, you know, like Charles was saying, that monotone dialogue just didn't do it for me. And in the comics, I mean, this is a shrieking, psycho, maniacal, evil entity. He's the embodiment of evil in the comics. And in this, it's a much more calculated and calm situation. He's not invoking the chaos that I feel like Ultron should invoke. And I don't think that he was, I don't know. I agree that he's just not, I don't know. I just felt like they didn't bring it to the table with this villain. And I think they could have done a lot more with it. And I feel like Ultron comes back and maybe we have another go and we, you know, we reintroduce the character or something. But I just feel like that this version of Ultron kind of fell short and was a little bit lackluster in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. So the comic book fans were not particularly happy with this. What about you, Leslie? You coming in fresh, as it were, and probably this being the very first time you actually ever saw Ultron. What did you think of what we got?
Yeah, interestingly, I didn't love him as a villain and didn't really know why. Other than the fact that I did want to, like exactly what Kelly said, I wanted to see more of a Joker menacing, you know what, I feel like they could have started where he is and then grown from there. I kind of felt like, you know, he was so curious at the beginning, and I liked that. I thought it would have worked if he had started off trying to figure it all out. Where is he? What is he? Who is he? Who's his enemy? Who's his friend? And then from there, it could have gone so much further, and I feel like maybe that's where they fell flat. They didn't go much further. When he did the upgrades, it was like there were physical upgrades, but there wasn't a whole lot of development in his character. James Spader is a great actor, and I did like some of the ways he delivered some of his lines, especially at the beginning. And I liked his confused, you know, he was sorry, then he was not sorry, and he really wasn't sure yet. But eventually they needed to get to a point where the character developed into that very sinister, strong villain. And I just don't think they ever got there with it.
Well, it seems like, you know, for the most part, you guys weren't fans of this. I mean, I know a lot of people who had problems more than anything with Ultron's designs. As I've read and heard, the fact they found that he has lips and at times even teeth, people thought looked just weird and jarring. Well, I suppose they could have made him more like his comic counterpart, and maybe instead of lips, they could have had that light pulsating when he talked, like, say, for example, the Daleks or the modern version of the Cybermen in Doctor Who. Though right. I don't find the fact they made him more anthropomorphic, as it humanizes him that much more and gives him more of a personality, bearing in mind, of course, that is a huge departure from the comics. I appreciate, though, they decided to really go to great lengths with their own narrative, i.e. he's a creature of Tony Stark and hence has his old man's quips and humor. So I will appreciate that. Also, I think that this could somewhat tie into what I had said in our discussion on this podcast about Bane in The Dark Knight Rises, which is that Ultron may actually not see as what he is doing as evil. He almost considers himself as a freedom fighter taken to the extreme by saying, I'm going to bring peace in our time by eliminating those who perpetrate war, i.e. the human race. Speaking actually of which, what did you guys think of this mission statement? Let's start with you, John. What did you think of that whole mission statement of peace in our time and how Ultron went about it?
I thought it was terrifying. That was one of the things I really liked about this film was the fact that, and he could have done anything that he wanted to destroy, like an extinction level event, but he's choosing to duplicate what happened with the dinosaurs. So it's like, obviously that it wiped them all out, and that whole piece in our time. And he thinks he's doing the right thing, and that was like one of the things I really enjoyed about this film.
And what about you, Kelly? I mean, did you at least appreciate the mission statement that Ultron was trying to carry out?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what I think that's what made him and Vision two sides of the same coin. One fell on one side, one fell on the other. And I think without that, it wouldn't have worked as well as it did in the confrontation between him and the Vision at the end. But the whole point of that was, you know, yeah, the level of event that he was trying to bring about, that's a scary type thing. I mean, you know, some people might say that we're experiencing that right now, but you know, it's definitely a crazy, crazy idea. The whole premise of it was great. I just, like I said earlier, I think the execution of the person behind it was not as great as the, you know, as the premise on which it was founded. So I think, yeah, it was definitely stand the hair up on the back of your neck kind of thought.
And what about you, Leslie? What, you know, speaking after the fact that Kelly said it is kind of very haunting to think that it is kind of what we're going through now. What do you think of should we say, Ultron's mission statement?
Yeah, well, I think the whole question there, even from the beginning of when Tony Stark and Banner are in the lab, is what is the definition of peace? And is it vanquishing the enemy? And if so, who's the enemy? And so when you've got Ultron deciding that the Avengers are killers and he has to extinguish them, you know, then it just grows into, okay, wait a minute, this, you know, what is the definition of peace? And he's got it all wrong, basically. And so that is actually, you're right. That is extremely, it's an extremely terrifying thought. And you know, that is something that worked really well for me as well.
Hmm. And what about you, Charles? You know, you having to deal with Doctor Who on almost a daily basis on your podcast. What do you think of this mission statement that Ultron brought? As I thought it could almost work in a Doctor Who episode.
Well, everybody should be so lucky to have to deal with Doctor Who on a regular basis, in my opinion.
I second that.
Yeah, thank you, John. I was hoping you'd step up. No, you know, the idea of Ultron creating this extinction level event is obviously, you know, it's definitely up there. You got to admire the ambition that Ultron is showing. My question though is, what was his plan for what happens after the event? There wasn't really any discussion of that. And it would have been nice to like at least have Tony or somebody else challenge him on that. Like, if you're going to do this, what happens then? And, but you know, I thought the way it was, you know, done was very well executed. I love the idea of this the Slovenian city rising up into the air, higher and higher. And, you know, it made for a very impressive threat, this ticking clock. And, you know, obviously, you know, the idea that the city is getting ripped out and all these people are being, you know, either killed by drones or just the devastation is just it's definitely, you know, like that perfect for a big budget superhero movie. But but I kind of would like to know, like, OK, what's your plan after? If you actually pulled this off.
That's a very good question that you raise. And now I so want Doctor Who to meet Ultron.
Well, you know, I think Ultron and Davros would get along famously.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. And so once Ultron is defeated, we are left with Thor going back to Asgard, Tony ostensibly taking a leave of absence from the Avengers, and Hulk flying away, and it falls to Cap and Black Widow to reform the team, which at this time consists of Falcon, War Machine, Scarlet Witch, and Vision. How would you guys say the dynamics between the Avengers have changed, and would you say that some cracks are showing? Let's start with you, Charles.
Yeah, I think you know, when I first saw that topic of yours, I thought, you know, now that I think about it, I think that is the case, that you kind of start to see, you know, the fissures a little bit. And because, you know, you see, you know, obviously the membership changes by the end of the movie. The team has been, you know, they go into that second act very emotionally compromised, almost broken in a lot of places. And, you know, I think there's some lingering effects there that, you know, that end up getting dealt with a lot in their own solo, you know, Marvel movies that take place after Avengers Age of Ultron. But, you know, it's you know, the one of the great, you know, something like this is always a great catalyst for change. And it was a great excuse to bring in those new members by the end, and in a kind of way to keep not only just to keep the franchise going, but to also kind of you know, acknowledge the fact that, you know, hey, in the comics, you know, Avengers rosters turn over on a pretty regular basis, and I think it was a great way to present that on in a motion picture setting.
Well, very well said. And what about you, John? What did you think of, you know, should we say the status of the status quo of the Avengers moving forward from this film?
Well, in the very beginning, in the battle against Hydra, you see them at what I like to think of them as like their heyday. Nobody can stop them. And then by mid movie, it's like, okay, they're kind of limping back with their tail between their legs. And they realize that, yeah, they're not all powerful. The fact that they do eventually bring in the new members and all that, and they have their own plans. I mean, like I said before, Tony just wants to retire. He doesn't want to do this his entire life. It just kind of shows them a little bit more directed as to what they eventually want to see with themselves and with the group itself.
Well, very well said. And what about you, Kelly? You know, what did you think of how our Avengers were left, as it were, after this movie was over?
Well, I think, like I mentioned earlier, I think you see the wedges being driven by Marvel all throughout the movie, between Banner and Stark, between you know, Cap and Stark and Thor and the rest of the Avengers. I mean, Thor's always had the God complex, and you know, I think he feels like, you know, I don't know. I think these characters, I think this movie is what was pulling apart the Avengers and that led us into, you know, the future movie like Civil War and stuff. And I think that's why a lot of this is, you know, it comes down to all the things that have happened throughout this movie. There was a lot of things that shook their faith in each other, you know, and I think Cap is in it in the end just out of a sense of obligation and a sense of, you know, things that he feels need to be protected. And I think Tony's in there for the same reason. And I think everybody was a part of the Avengers for their own reasons. But at the end of the day, I think this really fractured the team because, you know, Stark and against, you know, Banner's better judgment in some aspects, Stark creates this, you know, we've created these things that are coming to get us. We're our own worst enemy at this point. And I think that really fractured the relationship. Now, I think the relationship between, you know, Cap and the Black Widow and things like that, I think those still stay together. And the newer members, you know, this is all new to them. And they're, you know, they're kind of like, okay, well, let's give this a try. We didn't fit in anywhere. This may be our spot. The problem was with the older Avengers, and them have been, they've been together for so long, like John said, you know, the heyday part of it is kind of over. And now it's almost an obligation. They feel like that they have to save the world every time something like this happens. And so, you know, I think that wears on people and it wears on their psyche. And I think that's what we start to see at the end of this movie.
It certainly does. And what about you, Leslie? Would you say that the cracks are showing within the Avengers world by movie's end?
Oh, definitely showing. And I think dynamic changes have to happen in a franchise. You know, you have to have room for growth, room to go somewhere, room for more character arc, you know, and I think it also makes each character more relatable. And I mean, we can all relate to taking a beating and wanting to quit, not wanting to get up again. And, you know, Tony wants to retire, Nat wants to escape, Hulk does escape, you know, they just all want a minute, you know? And I think that what, you know, Ultron's goal was to, you know, he says to get them to fight against themselves basically. And there's no telling what kind of scars, Scarlet Witch's work has done. I mean, it's not something they're just going to forget about. You don't just go, well, we'll just forget that if it's a happy ending. And I think happy endings, are good, but you know, if the movie ends and everything is resolved, then why do we care about going on? And you know, I liked the setup with the breach of trust among several of them, you know, and it just makes you want to know, are they in it to the end no matter what, or are they going to go separate ways? And you know, it gives so much more to work with for future movies after this one.
It certainly does. I mean, I believe there's still quite a bit of tension, especially aimed at Tony Stark. I'm sorry, John, but that's just how it is.
That's okay.
And I think we did get some of that between Tony and Cap during the wood chopping scene. And you still wonder how much Wanda actually trusts Tony. Granted, the cracks are not as deep as what we get to see in Captain America Civil War, but the seeds have definitely been sown. So, guys, any final thoughts on the movie before we move forward?
I don't think so. I think we've covered everything so far.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So here we get to the part where Leslie will be taking notes. Do the three of you guys, when it comes to Charles, John, and Kelly, do you have any reading recommendations for our listeners who enjoyed this movie?
Well, if you're gonna get into this and you want to enjoy the movie, and Marvel kind of confuses you a little bit, but I think you should read The Origins of Ultron, which is Avengers number 54 through the 58, where they introduce Vision and Ultron. Then you go to The Return of Ultron, which happens in Avengers 66 through 68. And then Secret Wars obviously was a big one where Ultron was in. So it's Secret Wars 1 through 12. And then The Mighty Avengers, The Ultron Initiative, Mighty Avengers number 1 through number 6.
Yeah, and 1 through 6.
Yeah, 1 through 6, I believe. And yeah, I think those would be, if you really want to find out about Ultron and what he's about, I think those are some pretty good reading.
Very well said. And what about you, Charles? Do you have any reader recommendations for our listeners?
Yeah, I want to echo Kelly's recommendation for The Origin of Ultron in Avengers Volume 1, number 54 through 58 from 1968, because, you know, that's very key. You've got Hank Pym creating Ultron. You've got Ultron creating the Vision. So I think that's pretty much, you know, some essential reading right there, or recommended reading at least. And then I'd skip all the way to, if you're on the subject of Ultron, I'd go all the way to 1999 with Ultron Unlimited, which was in the third volume of Avengers from numbers 19 through 22. That was by Kurt Busiek and George Perez. I really love this storyline. It's very cool, and it's kind of reminiscent of Avengers Age of Ultron, where you have Ultron essentially demolishing this entire country of Slorenia, not to be confused with Slovenia. And, and you know, he constructs this robot army from its remains, so that's kind of cool, right? And if you want to look for in the mood for something for, like, the Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch, I would definitely check out Avengers Volume 1, number 16 from 1965, in a title that could only be written by Stan Lee, The Old Order Changeth, with art by the late great Jack Kirby, of course. So highly recommended there. And then, you know, this is where Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch join the Avengers for the very first time. Along with Hawkeye as well, so that's pretty cool. And then later I would recommend the Yesterday Quest that came from the 80s in Avengers Volume 1, number 185 through 187. That was by David Michelinie and John Byrne, where you have you find out all the really detailed origin of Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch, and what happened after they were born, and before, you know, obviously they grew up and later found out that their father was indeed Magneto.
Dun dun dun
dun dun dun. Which now we can see in Avengers, you know, movie, because hey, you know, the X-Men are coming back to the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Exactly.
So, very well said. I love that for sure. And what about you, John? Did you have any further recommendations for our listeners?
Kelly pretty much had the same ones I have here, but I just wanted to really take a look at 2007's The Ultron Initiative, Mighty Avengers 1 through 6. It's got a freaky twist to it. It really does. And the fact that it happens right after Civil War and Tony is seen in a completely different light, it just makes you really wonder about some of these characters.
Well, yes, for sure. And so our listeners, and I suppose Leslie as well, some great reading material to go on. And I think, Leslie, seeing the times we're going through, you definitely, you know, at least you have something to read. Indeed.
I've been taking notes this whole time, I will say.
Yes, well, homework.
I have homework.
The reason I like the Secret Wars is because Ultron faces off against Galactus.
Yes.
And so it's a really good... Secret Wars was good all around, but you get to see Ultron take on Galactus, and that was like one of my favorite parts of that series. So,
and that's and that, was, that was the real maniacal Ultron as well. Which,
yes,
I mean, who in their right mind is going to just go try to take Galactus. On Galactus?
Yeah, and that's like in the first issue.
Yeah, the ego on that guy was huge. So
huge. Yeah, exactly.
So, folks, you definitely have to check out Secret Wars indeed. So, guys, we selflessly promoted stories. Let's get to shameless self-promotion. Now, when it comes to you and what you do, where can our fine listeners find you on the interwebs? Let's start with you, Leslie.
Well, I'm a singer-songwriter, and I've just had this really lovely break from all of it for a while, and now I'm kind of feeling like I need to get back into things. So I'm going to release two or three, I'm trying to decide, albums this summer and stagger them. Got an acoustic and a country and then an inspirational album that just feels timely right now with everything going on in the world. So my website is lesliecoorsmather.com. And of course, I'm on, you know, all the social media sites, platforms, and YouTube and iTunes and all of those, Spotify, everything else. So looking forward to that. That'll be hopefully May or June at this point.
We definitely look forward to new music from you. And what about you, Charles? Where can our listeners find you on the interwebs? And tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, obviously, I'm the co-host on the podcasts, Next Stop Everywhere, the Doctor Who podcast that I do with Jesse Jackson and assorted special guest companions, including one John Takis, who we need to get back on the podcast. You've been very, very quiet, John. And just putting that out there. And also,
I gotta take a look at the stories you guys got coming up.
You do. Yeah, we got the schedule posted on our Facebook page. So yeah, you can check that out. Please do, because we want you back. We miss you. And my other podcast, of course, for Southgate Media Group, including the Phantom Zone podcast, where we talk comic book TV shows. That's also with Jesse Jackson. Titan Talk, the Titans podcast, where we talk the DC Universe shows, Titans and Doom Patrol. And Ghostwood, the Twin Peaks podcast that they do with Zan Sprouse, whom you've heard here on Happiness and Darkness. And she's obviously, as Nick knows, Zan is great. She's a very, very cool person, probably one of the coolest people I know. And I'm very fortunate enough to talk Twin Peaks with her. And we're actually planning a very big 30th anniversary episode coming up because, hey, next week is Twin Peaks 30th anniversary. So we're going to celebrate it by kind of doing our kind of traditional Mystery Science Theater-like commentary as we watch the original Twin Peaks pilot from 1990.
Nice.
So I hope everybody checks that out. That should be episode 72, I believe. And otherwise, you can find me on Twitter at Charles Skaggs or on Instagram at Charles Skaggs, Facebook, Charles Skaggs in Hilliard, Ohio, or all kinds of places like my blog, Geeky Things, Damn Good Coffee, and Hot. Would definitely appreciate it.
Well, definitely check out Charles and all the wonderful things that he does, because he's definitely very good at them. And when it comes to you, John, what tell us a little about you and where our folks can find you on the interwebs.
I'm not as active as everybody else, but I do run a little Doctor Who group in Ohio called the Ohio Type 40. We're one of the four large Doctor Who groups in the state. We're on Facebook. I don't think we're going to be branching off into too many other social medias just because of my work schedule. But yeah, we have a good time, and I just post pictures, stories, this, that, and the other. And I also have another little group that I just started recently last year, Type 2 Doctor Who. I decided to create a little diabetic support group since I was diagnosed as a Type 2 diabetic last year. So it's pretty much got a few members here and there, and we're all fans of Doctor Who, and we all suffer from Type 2 diabetes.
And that's beautiful for sure, and you know, more power to you for doing that. And finally, Kelly, what about you?
You can find me just about anywhere and nowhere at the same time. Veterans Forum every Saturday from 11 to 1 Mountain Time here in the United States. I do a broadcast for 2 hours and we discuss veteran issues, community issues, whatever comes up. We tackle a lot of hard subjects. We also do a lot of charity work for, you know, different veterans charities around the country, especially 22 Until None, DV Farm, and Disgruntled Vets, and a few of the others. And then you can also find me on Facebook at Something Like Yesterday. And you can find my professional page, Kelly Pippen. That's easy to find. The band page has been suffering a little bit because of everything that's been going on, and we were due to release some stuff here this summer. It's been pushed back a little bit, so we're still working on it, but second album should be coming out here pretty soon, so if anybody gets a chance, hit us up. We're on Reverb Nation as well, so you can go find our music there, so...
Definitely. Well, we'll be sure to check out everything that also Kelly has going on. And also, of course, Kelly, we thank you very much for your service.
Oh, well, thank you guys.
Definitely.
Well, and of course, my people, if you want to be like our great co-host and join us here on the show to discuss a movie of your choice, feel free to shoot us an email at happinessanddarknesshow@gmail.com. We also really appreciate your thoughts and feedback about the show. You can reach out to us with those also at happinessanddarknesshow@gmail.com. Feel free to show your support by giving us a like on Facebook, where you'll find us as Happiness and Darkness. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we're at HiDarknessPod, or on Instagram under HimDarkness. Also, if you'd like to support the podcast, if feeling generous, you can hit the donate button on soundcloud.com/whiskeyandcigarettes or become patrons of ours on Patreon. That's patreon.com/happinessindarkness. We really appreciate that. Any donators will be able to pick the movie we next discuss, even pick one of the current co-hosts we discuss it with, or come on the show themselves to discuss the movie of their choice. And speaking of things to come, next week we'll be joined by Danielle Adams, who has chosen the 2004 Guillermo del Toro film Hellboy.
Nice. That's
awesome. I knew you'd like that one, Charles. That said,
love that movie.
When it comes to the four of you guys, once again, I look forward to having you back here on Happiness and Darkness, and I certainly thank you all for joining me today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah,
thanks for having me back.
Very fun.
Oh, well, the pleasure was certainly mine. Well, folks, thanks as always for listening to the show and supporting us. We will see you next week with Danielle Adams and Hellboy. Until then, stay super. Ciao, my people.